Regardless of where you stand on the matter of data science sexiness, it's simply impossible to ignore the continuing importance of data, as well as our ability to analyze, organize, and contextualize them. Data are changing how our businesses and societies function. They are being used to solve a ton of interesting problems and shaping the questions we can ask of the world around us. Hi, I'm James Lee, and this is DataCast. Join me for raw conversations with practitioners from the worlds of AI, machine learning, statistics, and data science.
Hi listeners, this is DataCast. We hold long-form in-depth conversation with data and ML practitioners and researchers, unpack the narrative shows in the career. My guest today is Krishna Ghet, the founder and CEO of FitAI, a model performance management startup that helps AI-powered organizations to build trusted AI solutions and connect model outcomes to business KPIs. FitAI addresses problems in model monitoring, explainability, analytics, and fairness. As an entrepreneur and engineering leader with strong technical experience in creating scalable platforms and delightful products, Krishna previously held senior engineering leadership roles at Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, and Microsoft. At Facebook, Krishna led the news feed ranking platform that created infrastructure for ranking content and powered use cases like Facebook stories and recommendations like people you may know, groups you should join, etc. His team built Facebook's explainability features like Why Am I Seeing This, which helped bring much-needed algorithmic transparency and thereby accountability to the news feed for both internal and external users. So yeah, with that introduction out of the way, Krishna, it is my pleasure to chat with you this morning.
Thank you, James. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to start our conversation a little bit with your educational background. So I did a bit of research on your profile, and I believe that you studied computer science for undergrad back in India in the late 90s. And then after finishing your bachelor degree, I believe you moved to the US at the University of Minnesota to pursue a master's degree in computer science. And in fact, you actually spent some time there doing research, working on tooling for document clustering and pattern discovery as well. Yeah, can you just maybe give a brief summaries about your overall academic experience? And also, how did you become interested in some of these research areas?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, like most Indian students that come to America, I finished my undergrad in the late 90s and pursued to do graduate school in the US. One of the areas that I got really interested was data mining. If you remember, like the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of research happening in association rule mining. One of the seminal papers was, research was like where researchers looked at Walmart transaction data and were able to find some very interesting patterns. In fact, I still remember that one of the most interesting discoveries from that was like, there's a funny example where they found this really interesting correlation between people buying like beers and then diapers. And they were like confused. Why is there such a high correlation in those transactions? It turns out like what they found was, you know, a lot of dads, when they go back home, like on their way back home, were stopping by Walmart, and they were basically trying to get like a beer for them and as well as get diapers for their kids. So it's very interesting. And so then the Walmart, I think at the time, they started rearranging their aisles based on this, and so that, you know, you're trying to help the customers find the items much more quickly, right? So there are a lot more applications for those type of techniques, especially in web and text mining. So I worked a lot on document clustering, and this was still like the search engine era. Like, so we were basically, a lot of teams were crawling the web and trying to make sense of the web, and Google search was just launched, and then there was Yahoo search, and Microsoft was working on Bing. So it was a lot of efforts were going into understanding the web and understanding the textual data. And so I spent a lot of time working on clustering algorithms, developing algorithms that would make sense of these large text data sets.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, a bit of context. And just out of curiosity, like, how was your overall just academic experience at Minnesota, graduate school experience?
It was great. I think Minnesota has a very good computer science program. I was lucky to be working with couple of professors who were pioneers in data mining and graph partitioning, Vipin Kumar, who's still there, and also George Karipas, who's actually on a hiatus. He's actually working at Amazon. But yeah, they were like really pioneering research in bioinformatics, data mining, text mining, climate modeling. So I got a lot of opportunities to work with them and publish papers and stuff like that. So yeah, it was awesome experience.
Absolutely. So you talk about how you cultivate that interest in pattern discovery and search mining, given the fact that this is the domain innovation in the web during this era. And actually after finishing grad school, you decided to join Microsoft. And then you spent about, I believe, 5.5 years working specifically on the Bing search engine, right? Very relevant to current job results. And this is a product that Microsoft has built to compete against Google. And I believe you're also the key engineer behind Bing's index query infrastructure, and also suggest backend, as well as the contextual display ad system. So can you maybe give a high level overview of some of these engineering projects you work on, and like at a high level, what was like the most valuable lesson you learned from Microsoft?
Yeah, after working in school on data mining related areas, I wanted to work in building a web search system, and Microsoft was having a small team of 25 people. It's almost like a startup within Microsoft, trying to build kind of a Google killer at the time. And so it was a really exciting opportunity to work with a small team and build a search engine from ground up. So I took up that opportunity and joined the team. And so being new and being in a such young team, we were all figuring it out, right? So everything was new. In those days, Microsoft used to run Linux servers for maintaining their data centers, including Hotmail. And Bing was one of the first software systems that was built on clusters of Windows 2003 in those time. And eventually that sort of all of the infrastructure that we built got repurposed for Azure and things like that that you use today. So a lot of groundbreaking in work was done in Bing. I was lucky to be part of the search quality team. So we worked on building PageRank graph-based algorithms to compute importance of web pages, and also autocomplete. I was the first, now Bing's first autocomplete, which provided quick suggestions for users when they come to the search box. And then we also had worked on some really novel projects. For example, one of the things that we wanted to do was, how do we bring search traffic to Bing? So we had a lot of MSN pages and properties. So we wanted to run contextual ads, AdSense, but we used to call it SearchSense, where we would run those ads and show relevant search queries. If you're looking at a Michael Jordan related MSN page, you can actually see like a query that could show you like that could bring you back to Bing search. So those were some of the projects that I worked on. That one of the nice things about working in search engines is it includes pretty much every part of computer science. It touches distributed systems, machine learning, and algorithm development. So it was I really cherish my experience working on those. And I think it became like really the foundation for my career, those 5-6 years I spent at Bing.
Yeah, thanks for putting that into context. And just out of curiosity, what do you think, what are some of the biggest challenges of competing against Google, working on Bing? Maybe you can expand a bit more on.
I think the biggest benefit that Google had was they had a lot more data than Bing, right? Because they already had Toolbar that was launched to various browsers. So they were collecting a lot of like long tail query data. So this the thing with search engines is that the more you use the search engine, the more it has a chance to become better, because you'll collect more of the data. While at Bing, we developed very sophisticated algorithms. Like we actually productized one of the first neural networks for a large scale use case. I don't know if there is anything else before that. We productized an algorithm called RankNet, which was like a two-layer neural network that would essentially score the search results on a web page. And so we had very sophisticated algorithms. We had an army of Microsoft researchers that were working on these problems. But Google had better data, right? Because they had a lot more data. They had a lot more long-tail query data. So that eventually made it very difficult for Bing to come on par or even beat Google in terms of search quality. I think they kept on at it. And I think it's now the results are pretty much on par. But those were the challenges when we were working on. We had this metric that we would compare called NDCG, like a normalized discounted cumulative gain. It's a search quality metric, and we would try to always compare and how Bing would do for the same query versus Google. And
yeah, thanks for highlighting that distinction. I think just emphasizing the fact that data is is more important in developing this application compared to sort of algorithms, right? And that kind of break reflect on, like, even nowadays with the rise of like data-centric AI and these various things that we talk about, data quality, right?
Absolutely.
So, Peter, stepping back into your career in early 2010, you joined Twitter as a senior engineering manager. And I believe that you spent the first 2 years as an engineer working in Twitter search, building the infrastructure and user-facing features such as Early Bird, Blender, and Tigerhead. Could you share some of the high-level technical and operational challenges that you encountered during the development and scaling phase of Twitter search?
Yeah, so after 5-6 years at Bing Search, I wanted to move to the Valley, always wanted to work in startups. And so I had got this opportunity to join a small team, about 100 people were working on Twitter at the time. And they were looking to build a search engine. So they already had a search engine, but they were trying to scale that search engine out and also build a lot more features and functionality. And so I joined the search team. And again, so it was again a ground floor opportunity to rebuild the search engine. So at the time, the Twitter search was very rudimentary. So they would actually show all the tweets in a MySQL database, and they would have a Ruby on Rails app that query the MySQL and basic text queries, subqueries, and SQL. It's not really a search engine. There was no real search index. So it worked well for some time for them, but very soon as Twitter scaled in terms of users and traffic, it didn't really scale. So I was hired, and along with a few others, to build a real search engine. So as part of, we brought in Lucene as an open source search engine within Fiddler, and Early Bird was basically a real-time implementation of Lucene. So Lucene at the time was very good at batch processing data. So you could actually give a batch of documents and Lucene would index them, and you could then query Lucene search index. But then didn't have the support for real-time ingestion. So we wanted to build a search engine where tweets would be coming in and a few seconds later, they're available for search queries. And so that was a novelty that was the most important for Twitter because it was a very real-time product. And so Early Bird came out like that in terms of modifying Lucene and making it work for real time. Fortunately, we had a Lucene committer on the team, so he was able to make a lot of progress to actually making the core parts of Lucene work. And then once we built that, we needed a way to scale the system so that we could create lots and lots of different search queries. For example, you may want a search query that filters only tweets from your friends, or you may have a search query that looks at scores the documents in a relevance order versus time order. So we used to call them different ways of blending search results. You may want to blend in user results and tweet results in the same query. So I basically was a tech lead for the project Blender. And the other thing was the Ruby on Rails front end was also having scaling issues. And this was around the time where the tsunami happened. And we were receiving humongous amount of traffic. People were using Twitter in Japan because everything else was not available to them for communication. They were able to find out where everyone is and all through Twitter. So we had a huge amount of traffic spike, and the search front end couldn't handle that. So we developed this JVM-based application, Blender, that sort of brought in like really high scalability, but also brought in the ability to blend search results through these workflows that developers can author. The pipeline that you could in the data infrastructure world, but in this case, the pipeline is actually a query pipeline running at runtime, where you can compose it, saying that okay, call the Early Bird service, get the results from it, give it to the ranker, get the ranked result, call like another service, get back like the user network, and then filter out the user network from the search results. So you can orchestrate all of these calls using a very simple workflow. So it made it easy for developers to write search queries. So those were some of the projects that I worked on. And then also, like when we were starting to build Typehead, since I already built one at Bing, I worked on that, built like the Bing's Typehead, which is same thing like autocomplete at Bing, at Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for kind of handling all those the modification you made to the search product and moving from batch to real time and re-architecting sort of the front end, right, to make it more workable given this traffic. And it sounds like this is one of the unique challenges with working with Twitter is this aspect of the streaming data, right, given the nature of working in a consumer company like Twitter. Just zooming in on that aspect a little bit, you have built this platform with Twitter to help process streaming data scale to Power's raw features. We talk about search, but this is one of the things like trending topics and advertising recommendation, right? Just looking back at that time, can you share any key lesson learned from building this critical data infrastructure at Twitter?
Yeah. So one of the big differentiators of Twitter was it was a very extremely real-time product, right? We had streaming data coming in through tweets, and it's a big USP for the product and compared to other media networks at the time. And so we needed special infrastructure to process all of this data. After spending a couple of years in search, I got this opportunity to build a data infrastructure team more on the backend side to create streaming infrastructure to process these tweets coming at time and enable lots of use cases. It could be like trending topics, as you said. Could be like creating features for ad scoring. So we had a lot of machine learning models running at the time, even in those days, to score ads. And how do we make sure we are providing the freshest data to them? Also analytics. So we wanted to measure our own ads and tweets, how they're performing so that we can analyze them. So doing our real-time analytics. Those were some of the really big use cases. And at the time, Twitter acquired a small startup that was working on this open source project called Apache Storm. And so we then brought that project into it, and I built a team around that project where we actually productionized it within Twitter and made it work for lots of use cases. And then started, by the time I left Twitter, we were also trying to rebuild the next version of Storm, rewriting it into a different language. And so that eventually became Twitter Heron, which again launched in the open source world. So that was my experience of data. And apart from that, we were also working on key value stores and distributed caching systems on the online data infrastructure side of things, so we can help our product teams serve tweets, serve users, serve all kinds of data that they want to serve to the users very quickly.
Yeah, thanks for sharing all this context. It does sound like there's a lot of challenges with working with real time, and both from offline and online production. And also, it sounds like the company is heavily advocated using open source project, like you mentioned, Apache Lucene and Apache Storm, which haven't even...
Yeah, Twitter benefited a lot from open source. Lucene, Storm, Memcache. We also contributed a lot back to open source. For example, Mesos was big, obviously, before Kubernetes. Mesos was like the orchestrating system for kind of the data center operating system. And Storm, Finagle, an RPC library that, you know, that a lot of people use to orchestrate requests between JVM services. Yeah, Twitter was huge on open source.
Sure. Now, so you got that expert in building data infrastructure development at Twitter for a while. But after spending about 4 years there, you joined Pinterest in 2014 as the head of data engineering, leading a team working on OTX data from analytics, experimentation, logging, and infrastructure. What would you say to be some of the more notable accomplishments of your team during your time there?
Yeah, so around that time, the whole big data thing was like really popular, right? Like every company was trying to get into big data. How do we make sense of big data? How do we create infrastructure to process, analyze data? So after some experience of building data infrastructure at Twitter, I got this opportunity to build a data infra team from ground up. Again, at another startup, just growing really fast. And Pinterest was like a unique product because it was somewhat like a social media network, but somewhat like a search engine. So you know, like a bit of both. They used to call it the discovery engine. So where you could go and discover ideas and things that you want to see. And so it was a really interesting product. Again, data was at the center of it because when you want to show new pins and new recommendations to users, you needed to mine the data and actually create a lot of insight and intelligence from it. So this was a great role. And so we started out building the data infra at Pinterest. We were a very small team. So we had also to partner with different startups and AWS. Also, Pinterest being a modern company, modern tech company, we had the advantage of actually building on cloud providers. So we were, unlike Twitter, we actually had the advantage of building on AWS from day one. So it was a very interesting opportunity for me to learn how to create data architecture and create data infrastructure from scratch. So we were like, those days we were productionizing what Kafka very early, like Spark very early. So we interacted with the founding teams like of Confluent and Databricks and quite a bit. And then Snowflake also just came along at the time. So we were actually productizing Presto, which is like the Facebook's data analytics engine. So it was a lot of fun time building a lot of this data infrastructure to meet the company's needs.
Yeah, thanks for giving that kind of overview. I want to zoom in a bit more on some of the specific engineering projects that your team work on. And I was able to read some blog posts about this period what your team had been putting on, from doing real-time analytics to building ETL as a service to building an A/B testing experimentation platform. Maybe can you go over like some high-level design implementation of these initiatives?
Yeah, for a real-time analytics, we had to build everything from ground up. So we had to roll out our own logging agent called Singer that would essentially run on every web server that we that Pinterest was running. Pinterest was a Python show. And so we had these Python web servers that would serve the user traffic, and they would be logging to this agent called Singer, and which is basically a JVM agent that would then take all of the data and publish into a centralized Kafka infrastructure. And from there on, we would then feed this data into real-time databases. Like we leveraged MemSQL at that point. We also used Redshift and a few other databases, HBase, where we would publish this data so we can compute real-time insights. Well, one such insight was being able to know things around experimentation. So one of the things we had to do was we built an A/B testing framework from ground up, where I said it's like a mix of search engine and social networks. So every single change that we made, whether it's a UI change or an algorithm change, had to be tested on user pop. Testing was really big. And so our team supported the A/B testing framework. And what we needed to know is when an experiment was configured correctly or not very quickly, so we don't expose an experiment to a lot of population. So real-time analytics was very important for us to quickly understand if experiments were configured properly or not, so we can roll back those experiments that were generating bad data. And then ETL as a service, we had a lot of analysts that would be answering insights around, okay, what new markets should we go into? So for example, if we are expanding into Japan, what kind of pins would they like? What kind of recommendations should we show? And so for them, they would run a lot of these Hive queries and Presto queries. And then after that, those queries they would become like these ETL jobs that basically help them create reports. So we created an entire analytics end-to-end infrastructure called Pinalytics, where you can start with a simple Hive query, get some ad hoc results, and then use like ETL as a service, which is essentially an internal service, to convert that query into an ETL job, which will then make you a report on the Pinalytics, which is like a front-end report. So it's beautiful, actually. It was end-to-end, starting with a query, doing some ad hoc analysis, all the way to like continuous reporting.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting those. Sounds like a lot of these initiatives really improved the productivity of the data analysis, data scientists, allow them to be more impactful with the dashboard and reporting and experiment.
Absolutely. And in fact, a lot of that experience is now helping with Fiddler as well, because you know, at the time when we were working on Pinterest, we were supporting these product analysts and data scientists trying to measure the product. Mm-hmm. But now essentially what we're doing at Fiddler is we're trying to help the ML engineers and data scientists focusing on ML create reports around ML and share it within the organization. So a lot of the stuff that we have done at Pinterest has really helped me building Fiddler.
Just to start, Kirsty, so you were the head of data engineering at Pinterest. How did the organization structure, like how did the data engineering interact with the analytics function and the data science function back then?
It was a very flat organization. I was reporting to the VP of engineering, who would report into the CEO. The VP of engineering had like a bunch of different functions. Data, which was basically I was putting in the core infrastructure, which is all the runtime services, and then product, search, mobile, those were like a few teams that he was leading. And then the business analysts and the data scientists, especially the data scientists focusing on product measurement, were sitting in the operations team. So there was like a separate team that reported to the COO that was working on, they had a pretty sizable team, almost people working on business analytics and data scientists at the time. Now the organization structure may have changed, but they were basically in operations and they would support the product team and also marketing and sales, different teams with these insights and requests that they'll get.
Yeah, so it's very decentralized structure. Yeah. So the importance of having a self-serve platform is going back into your career up to 2.5 years at Pinterest. You spend the next 2 years as an engineering manager at Facebook, building some of the cutting-edge machine learning algorithms for news recommendation in the Facebook feed. Could you mind unpacking some of the major machine learning model performance issue with running that feed ranking platform?
Yeah. So after spending some time in Pinterest, again, I wanted to be more closer to where I live. I didn't want to, I was doing a long commute to the city for about 7 years. So I took up a really good gig at Facebook. It was, again, an opportunity to build a team from scratch. So Newsfeed had a very large ranking team, lots of ML engineers building models to score Newsfeed. But they didn't have really good tools to understand how the models were working, to monitor those models, to create experiments around those models. So I was given the charter to build a ranking platform team, like to create tools and infrastructure for the Newsfeed ranking engineers. And when we started surveying what problems were the engineers facing, one of the big problems was every time some exec or someone internally within Facebook complained about something like Newsfeed quality issue, they would have to go and spend hours debugging what happened. Was it a data issue or a model issue or a feature issue? And so the very first project we took on was like feed debugger. So we built a feed ranking debugger that developers could use to debug how their machine learning models were working. You know, so they could use this debugger to find out if a stale model was running for this market, if a bad experiment was configured, or some bad data was flowing into the system, or even explainability related insights where they could see which features were scoring higher versus low for this story versus other story, really help them to understand and improve feed quality. Eventually, what started out as an intern building this feed debugger became a big team. We had a feed quality effort, also from an operations perspective as well, which helped us get all the complaints, like tickets come flowing. Yeah, every employee at Facebook was also a Facebook user. So we had tens of thousands of, you know, requests like around improving feed quality every day. So you get all of these requests and get prioritized. You know, the real bugs would get that fixed. So it was a huge, we were able to make a huge dent in the feed quality with this tool. Apart from that, there was a lot of other requirements around being able to configure, set up experiments, monitor experiments. Facebook was this continuous development type of company, a lot of velocity in developers, ship features. So they needed to run experiments continuously, especially ML-related experiments. So we built infrastructure so that they could analyze those experiments very quickly and understand whether to ship an A-B test or not. We had a very good process around launch reviews, which A-B tests should get shipped. And so our team helped create some of those dashboards that they could share within those launch reviews so that they know which experiment is working, which experiment is not, to the executives or the Newsfeed leadership. So those were some of the projects that my team was building. And that's how I got into explainability and kind of model monitoring.
For sure. It sounds like you were applying a lot of the playbook from Twitter and Pinterest in terms of source of platform infrastructure, right? To how this data scientist and machine at Facebook to build these ranking models. Right. So having those platforms is important for them to debug and diagnose their models in production. So you mentioned a little bit about how that becomes the segue for your entrance into AI, explainability, and model monitoring. This is around the 2016 areas, and there was a lot of things around, especially after the election of 2016, I believe.
Yeah.
And this area's algorithmic integrity and transparency, I guess, become critical issues, especially at Facebook, given the size and how it plays in the political movement. And I believe that your team also started working on putting guardrails to the AI algorithms, checking for their integrities, and building debugging and diagnostic tooling tools to understand and explain how they work.
Yeah.
So can you share some of the lessons you learned from algorithmic governance from Facebook?
Yeah, I think what happened with Facebook as they developed lots and lots of machine learning models, they started with a very simple logistic regression model for a newsfeed in 2020. And within 4 years, that became ensembles of large models. We were using sparse neural networks and lots of complex deep learning models to score newsfeed, to bring new recommendations. So we would get constantly questions like, why am I seeing this story? Why is this story going viral? And before we built these tools, those questions were very difficult to debug and answer. So part of it was we were able to create transparency into how Newsfeed worked with these tools. In fact, the tool itself was called Why Am I Seeing This? Where we launched it to every employee within Facebook so they could actually go and debug their own Newsfeed. Because every Newsfeed is personalized, right? So you can go and load up your Newsfeed in that Why Am I Seeing This tool and look at what you're getting here, look at the reasons why you're getting suggested that content. And if you disagree with it, you can actually go and file a ticket with the feed quality team and then get reviewed, right? So this created this like process around rhythmic transparency, giving a power to the newsfeed employees, Facebook employees to give back a lot of feedback. And it helped us to improve feed quality for a period of time. And it also helped us to, this was the first, I would say, high-scale explainability tool that was launched. Eventually, Facebook ran it also for end users for a while. I think it was also called, why am I seeing this? And they had a product announcement, if you search on the web, which actually showed these human-readable explanations on why a user was seeing like a cat picture versus or some other story in their newsfeed. So it was the very first, I would say, the very first algorithmic transparency tool that was ever developed in the industry. And I think, yeah, that was the exciting part. And that's what kind of motivated me to start Fiddler, because you know, Facebook could build these things, Google could build these things, but like not every company would want to build these things and may not be able to build it. And so that's how we got started on Fiddler. And there are so many other implications, right? Because how the kind of situation Facebook was in at the time as a company, the kind of data privacy issues it was facing, these tools were very important. They had very high visibility all the way to the chief product officer and whatnot. So that's what we felt we needed to bring to the enterprise and started our journey with Fiddler.
Yeah, thanks for sharing the origin story and how the interest in algorithmic transparency become that seed that allows you to create Fiddler. And we'll talk about that right in a bit, but just want to maybe ask you a question about kind of some of your experience working in this companies, right? So you spend about 8 years at Twitter, Boston, and Facebook, very big, large consumer focused company. What valuable leadership lesson have you absorbed from building teams that create scalable platforms and delightful consumer products?
Yeah, the common theme amongst all these companies is like scale of data. Like all of these companies in some ways were building data products, whether that is Twitter search or Pinterest home feed or newsfeed ads. Their own data products, so one of the common themes is that you need to invest a lot in infrastructure that can process this data, clean the data, make sure it's available for a lot of people in a good way. And you have guardrails around how you can use the data. And then eventually, like, how do you make sense of data, make it easy to build tools to either mine insights around the data or build models and create like new applications on top of the data. The leadership lesson is essentially being able to create like the foundation layer, like really strong. So invest a lot in the infrastructure around data and machine learning so you can actually empower your business and product teams. If you see like all these three companies have been massively successful, I've joined them very early in their life cycles, especially Twitter and Pinterest. And one of the primary reasons is because of how much they've invested in infrastructure.
Yeah, so focus on the foundational bedrock to data by building that infrastructure.
Right.
And it definitely sounds like what has been propelled analytics usage at all this dashboard subcompany at this point. So you mentioned inspiration for Fiddler started from your time at Facebook. So you started Fiddler, I believe, in October 2018.
That's right.
You've been co-founder and CEO back then. And the company's mission is to build trusted into AI. So can you share the story behind the founding of Fiddler?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think as you probably noticed, I've built a lot of backend infrastructure and help internal developers or data scientists or analysts become more productive, be more efficient. That's been the common theme in my career. And so naturally, I always wanted to do an enterprise startup. So where I could take what I'm doing, take all the lessons that I've learned and build a platform that many developers, many data scientists, many analysts can use. But I was waiting for the right problem. What was a compelling problem that could pull me to go and do your company? Because it's doing a startup is also very hard. You need to be prepared to take some risks and go through the whole roller coaster journey. And when I was working on explainable AI at Facebook, that's when I found a problem that was technically very hard. How do you explain these complex machine learning models? We still are at a very superficial level in terms of what we can do with it. And then how do we then make a product that, you know, essentially that can have a social impact, right? Because oftentimes in enterprise companies, you may build a great database or a great networking infrastructure, but the social impact is like many levels removed from it, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in this case, by actually making AI trustworthy, Fiddler is able to create a dent in society, make impact on the society directly. So I was excited about the social impact of it. And the third one is that you need to be able to make a business out of it. People should need this product and they should be able to pay money toward it. And what I found from my experience working on Explainable is that actually it's a problem that sort of appeals to not just the developers, but also the executives as well. Because if you look at every C-level exec today, when they look at advances in AI, like the ChatGPT or the Stable Diffusion or these GPT advanced AI use cases, they all look like black magic to them. And how do they work? What is going on behind the scenes? So while the advances in AI are very exciting, there is also a lot of risks that come with it. And so that's where our opportunity, we found that, hey, Fiddler can make a difference and actually create a business. So those three things compelled me to start Fiddler and be on this journey for 4 years now.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to recap, so the technical innovation, the social impact, and sound business visibility, those three criteria that combined together allows you to make the lift to look at venture.
And it's very rare to get all three of them. Usually you get maybe two of them. It's very rare to get all three, especially in an enterprise company. And so this was too good of an opportunity for me to pass up.
Sure. And I believe you co-founded a company with your co-founder, Amit Parker, who used to work on product recommendation at Samsung. I believe, can you share a bit more about the co-founder relationship? How did you meet and decide to work together?
Yes, when I wanted to start the company, I wanted to look for someone with complementary background, someone that is obviously trust built in, perhaps. So Amit and I know each other for way back, like almost 20 years. We were in the same grad school together. We worked at Microsoft together. So I know him for a long time. And he also did startups before. So I also wanted someone with prior startup experience because I didn't have early stage, meaning founding experience. So he founded two startups, had good exits with PayPal and Samsung. So he was someone who could bring that startup operational experience and logistics and everything that goes into building a startup, and also who could be by my side through that journey, right? That's very important that you need. It's startups are chaotic journeys, and so you need someone who you can trust and depend upon. So yeah, so though that was great match because he brought in product background, operational background, and so he served as the product leader for the first 3 years of Fiddler, built the initial versions of the product, and then recently stepped into an operational leadership role as we scaled out the product team and brought in new people. So that's been our partnership so far.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for sharing the insight. Someone who can complement your skill set with experience as well. Talking specifically about the Fiddler product, I want to zoom in on this blog post you wrote all the way back in June 2019, an article titled AI Needs a New Developer Stack. And this article lists the challenges adopting AI successfully, as well as the tools needed to allow developers to meet these challenges. Can you unpack some of the key challenges and the tools in the article?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you could see in that article, we talk about this is obviously a few years old, but a lot of this applies today as well, right? If you look at companies that actually have built ML platforms in-house, the Googles, the Facebooks, or the Ubers, of the world, they build end-to-end ML infrastructure that solved all these challenges from data labeling to feature engineering to training, model evaluation, deployment, model serving, and monitoring. And it requires a lot of effort. It requires an army of engineers. FB Learner team at Facebook was a very large team that focused on all of this end-to-end infrastructure and provided a huge impact for every team, like Newsfeed. I had so many teams that would run models on their infrastructure. So the purpose of this article is that not every team can actually build this. The other thing is it's a new workflow. As machine learning becomes the new software artifact in the enterprise, this is the new developer stack that one needs to build. You need to have a tool that you can keep all of your training data. You can clean it, make it work for you. So then, unfortunately, now there are tools like Labelbox, Scale that exist today to do that. And you're working on one such tool. That's superb, I imagine. And then after that, you need feature engineering. You need being able to explore what kind of features that you want on mine for. And there are tools for that, feature stores that are available for you to keep track of all of these features. And then you need to train your models, evaluate those models. So now there are lots of tools available again, like the SageMakers of the world, the open source frameworks of the world. And then how do you then deploy those models as are you going to deploy them in a batch-oriented manner where you're running it on a Spark pipeline, or you're going to serve it on a behind a container-based endpoint. Again, there are multiple tools out there, the Rays of the world, the Seldons of the world that can help you do that. Then you need to monitor those models. So you can monitor versions of the models, analyze how the models are working. And that's where we come in. So you need this kind of this LAMP stack, or probably much more than LAMP, maybe like a bunch of tools that you need to connect together to create your ML ops workflow. And that's what it talks about. And without these tools, you cannot really build this software 2.0, or it's a pithy term, but essentially if you call AI as a software 2.0, you cannot really do it. And the real inputs for this is data, right? It's not so much about the code. It's this whole data-centric view of actually creating AI and deploying and maintaining it. And so that was basically the kind of the gist of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. You wrote this blog post back in 2019, which is, I think it's very early days of like this whole MLOps movement. So in some way, I thought like you predict how the movement is going to go, right? And you make this requirement and ask request at such an early phase of the movement. So just out of curiosity, how do you see the landscape evolve since you have written the blog post? It's been like almost 4 years now, I suppose.
Yeah. I think one thing is like MLOps is truly underway, right? When we started writing the article, we would still talk about, hey, have you heard of FB Learner? Have you heard of Michelangelo? Have you heard of TFX? Do you have one such platform? If not, what are you going to do about it? People would still weren't aware of all of these things. So there's a lot of lack of awareness. Market was not just about to start. So now there's a lot of awareness. Teams are on the journey of MLOps. And when they see things like the ChatGPTs of the world, people are like, oh, if you're not on it, we are going to miss out on it. So let's actually make AI happen within our enterprise. So that's one. The second trend that also started, which also what we see, is this whole aspect of not only you need to do MLOps, but you also you need to do it. The whole concept of responsible AI, which sort of bleeds into you bringing multiple parties together. Are you looking for biases in your data? Are you having continuous model reporting and monitoring? Are you having explainability and all sorts of those things? So the thing, interesting thing is Fiddler tries to span both of these worlds, right? On one hand, there's this core nuts and bolts of actual building MLOps systems that kind of make it work for you. But at the same time, we want to help the companies do it right, not make mistakes in it. And I think that is the opportunity that we're riding. And we are seeing that on responsible AI also taking like some taking off. And I think we're riding these two waves, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. We touched on responsible AI and adoption of MLOps. Yeah, a little bit later on our chat, but I want to reserve the next couple of questions to talk about the product specifically.
Yeah,
Fiddler is pioneering a new part of workflow trusted AI solution with what you call the Model Performance Management Framework, MPM for short, which is a centralized control system at the heart of ML workflow that tracks and watches the model performance at all the stages and close the ML feedback loop.
Yep.
Would you mind explaining some of the key benefits of using this framework to address enterprise MLOps challenges?
Absolutely. So I think if you look at the big problem with machine learning models in terms of how the MLOps works today, is it's very linear, right? Like most teams do not retrain their models. They just develop them, deploy them, and forget about them. And we have seen some sort of effects of that during the pandemic, especially in the financial industry, where the models can age like up to years, right? You might develop a credit risk model, may not even touch it for like more than a year. And what has happened during the pandemic is everything changed in front of our eyes. Supply chain changed, people lost jobs, unemployment rate changed, interest rates changed. So that disrupted every single model that people were developing, right? And people started realizing this aspect of, hey, we don't have a feedback loop. We don't know when our models are decaying. One of the classic examples was where I think it was Instacart or someone that blogged about how their inventory management models decayed in performance from 90% accuracy to 60%. So you see like people coming up with these issues, and they found out that they didn't really have this feedback. And if you look at control theory, obviously, you know, there's open loop systems and there are closed loop systems. Open loop systems are things where they don't have any feedback loop. They just work as you give the input, they produce the output. Whereas the closed loop systems have the feedback loop, where take the case of a cruise control in a car, where you can actually increase the gas pedal. You actually see the feedback on the speedometer, and you can create an automated cruise control that can actually monitor the speedometer and then set the speed at a certain rate. And so that was the vision behind the whole model performance management framework, where How can we build a closed loop system for machine learning? We're continuously getting feedback. So the feedback is essentially how is the model predicting? What features it is looking at? When you get labeled data from your models deployed, how does the model perform against the labels that you're getting? How is it affecting your business metrics that are associated with them? Like, for example, if you're building a recommendation model, whether it's actually improving likes or clicks or additions to cart, if you're building a credit risk model, is it reducing losses? Is it improving the first paid installments? So being able to look at those metrics and quickly being able to then grab them into the feedback loop and then closing the feedback loop, you can provide actionable insights to say that, hey, this model is drifting. You need to fix this, or this data pipeline is broken. This feature is actually broken, or this feature is showing the null values and it's actually having a big impact on the model, or this feature has shifted in distribution and it's actually having a big impact on the model performance. So go fix it. So that closing of the feedback loop, today it's still fiddler requires still a human in the loop there, where a human would still look at those actionable insights and try to do the work. In the future, we want to automate it as much as possible while still keeping them in the loop, but also doing a lot of work for them, giving a lot more actionable insights to them to fix their ML pipeline.
Yeah, thanks for talking about the conceptual ideas behind the MVM framework and how it inspired the closed system. And I suppose this is heavily inspired by the APM framework, right? Application.
Exactly. The APM framework, we already know when you actually deploy an application, you want to observe the performance, the latency, the CPU usage, memory usage of it, so that when it's about to tank, you can go and expand its resources or do something with it. If it's having bug, if you deployed a bug, you can go and fix that bug and get a stack trace back for you. So very similar analogy.
Yeah. So that's the conceptual level a bit. And in terms of the actual implementation level, the platform includes features like model monitoring, explainable AI, analytics,
yep,
and fairness. So can you give a brief overview of these features and capabilities that the platform supports?
Absolutely. The foundation of it is model monitoring. So we hook up to the models and the exhaust of the models. So the model could be running on SageMaker or Databricks or behind a container endpoint or your own custom inference server. They can log the predictions and the inputs that the model is seeing to Fiddler directly, or to some sort of a queue that Fiddler can read from, or to some sort of a centralized data lake like S3, HDFS, like that Fiddler can connect to and read from. So that's basically how we start. We grab all of the data and we help you monitor the performance of the model. So we look at shifts in distribution. So for example, let's say you have a credit risk model and it has 4 or 5 attributes: loan amount requested, previous income of the customer, what was his previous debt, and what. And so then as you're collecting the data of new loan applications, you're then looking feature distribution shifts. Are loan amounts increasing over a period of, like, week over week is shifting? Are people asking for higher loan amounts or lower loan amounts? Or is the income level that of loan applicants shifting from the time that you train the model with? Let's say you only train the model with high income applicants, but now suddenly you're getting low income applicants. Now, how does the model perform, or vice versa? So being able to track those distribution changes, data changes in amongst these features, and being able to alert you is a basic foundation of model monitoring. And then on top of it, we help you do root cause analytics, where we help you understand what happened for a particular slice. Let's say you started getting a bunch of false positives. Where is that happening? Is it happening across all segments, or is it happening on certain segments or certain slices of data? Maybe the credit risk model is not performing in a certain region or a certain type of users. So being able to uncover those and do root cause analytics is the next thing. And the third is explainability, where you can go and explain the reasons behind what happened. Why was this particular loan denied by this user? Why was this particular slice underperforming for this model? And when you actually know those reasons, you can fiddle with these inputs and actually ask counterfactual questions. You can say, okay, this loan was denied for this user. They're making $50,000 in salary. Now, what if they made $55,000 in salary? Would we have accepted their loan request? Or what if, like, their loan request was $1,000 lower than the original request? Would we approve that loan request? So being able to know that counterfactual analysis is so helpful, and helpful to help the customer, helpful to understand the model, the stability of the model. And then the final part is fairness, right? While you are building these models, while you are monitoring these models, being able to know how the model is performing on various different predicted attributes, like your gender, your race, ethnicity, your location, so many different things that you want to measure. So you can look at different segments of these predicted attributes and see how the model is performing on those. So you can find obvious cases where you need to go and look at. So that's the gist of it, like the four pillars of the Fiddler MPM product.
Yeah, thanks for explaining and zooming in on all these four pillars. And I think especially with the expandability and fairness pillars, I assume there's a lot of research that come into it, right? Like how to design algorithms that explain attributes, and especially with fairness, I think we talked a little bit about it. And I believe that Fiddler have a dedicated team of scientists who work on some of this problem, right? Could you mind sharing any high-level approach, R&D work to build this solution?
Yeah, especially explainability, drift metric calculations, and fairness require considerable amount of research because they're all new topics, right? We have a centralized data science team led by a chief scientist and chief AI officer who is a pioneer in this field. Krishnaram joined us a year ago. He was a tech lead for ethical AI when even ethical AI was not even the case, when way back in LinkedIn, and he also built some very interesting technology in Amazon. So he's leading the charge here. And in the research, when it comes to explainability, we actually have our own explanation algorithms that we've created inspired by Shapley values. We got some best paper awards for one of the algorithms that we created in 2020. In terms of fairness, we invested a lot in intersectional fairness. So what that means is you can look at fairness on one single predicted attribute at a time, but you can still have unfairness issues. So even the model could be fair if you just look at race alone or gender alone or some other, the geography alone. But if you combine those predicted attributes and look at intersections, then you can find more issues with the model. So the intersectional fairness talks about how do you look at fairness at these intersections of these predicted attributes, what kind of metrics that you need to measure. And so that's a paper that we published as well. And then when it comes to monitoring, one of the things that we invested a lot in is measuring drift of complex models. It's simple to look at drift for simple models that take scalar features. Let's say you have age or say income or transaction amount. You can look at distribution shifts of these features. But what if you have vector features? What if you have arrays of embeddings thrown at you? How do you then measure drift around that? So we've created novel techniques to compute drift, where you can compute drift in an NLP model or compute drift in a computer vision model and create one metric that you can alert on, right? So you can say, okay, if you have a vector of embeddings, we can compute a drift on that vector of embeddings and help you monitor that so that when that changes, you can get alerted and you can come and uncheck what's going on. So those are some of the investments that the data science team keeps, you know, working on.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, since you just mentioned on that last point, recently announced those capabilities of monitoring for unstructured data. And you mentioned like the technical know-how of how it works, measuring drifts of vector embeddings. Yeah, maybe can you also talk about like challenges of monitoring for these unstructured data versus traditional structured data and how like the adoption of the enterprise for these new use cases?
Yeah, so the traditional MLOps is all about operationalizing your traditional machine learning models, right? Your logistic regression models, your decision trees, your booster trees, your random forests, which are looking at a lot of scalar variables and trying to predict fraud or predict credit risk, predict churn, predict lifetime value. Those are the use cases, right, that we see a lot of teams. And a lot of MLOps is still that, right? And some of these models work really beautifully. And XGBoost is like a standard in financial service industry. You can build really sophisticated models with that. But then when you get into use cases of, say, conversational bots or image processing, or you're trying to look at identify objects within an image, especially around, let's say you're trying to look at compliance documentation and asking questions around it, or you're looking at customer sentiment analysis. So that's where people are investing a lot in advanced models, deep learning models, especially after the whole transformers-based architecture. There's a lot of popularity using BERT and other types of transformer models. Now, I guess GPT-3 has pushed it even further. So these models take their inputs in the form of embeddings, embedding-based features, right? So they're taking the raw inputs, and then the raw inputs are then converted into embeddings, and they're operating in this higher dimensional space when they're trying to infer the predictions. So a few challenges arise. Firstly, how do you explain these models in the first place? How do you explain a complex model? And secondly, how do you monitor them? The fact is these models are highly accurate, so they're able to provide amazing accuracy. So one of our customers recently productized a hybrid lending model where they would take some structured attributes, but then a lot of unstructured attributes like your previous credit card history and all. And they got a huge improvement in accuracy. Now, how do you launch that model? They need to explain that model. So we built a lot of explainability features to explain these complex models. And then from the monitoring perspective, being able to monitor drift in embeddings is difficult, right? Embedding itself is a hash. It's not an interpretable feature. How do you make that? How do you even track like shift in distributions of that? So for that, what we have come up with, the clustering-based technique where we'll take these vectors in high-dimensional space and cluster them into a small number of clusters, and then use these clusters to look at, to see, we compute that on the training data. And then when the production data starts flowing in, we assign the production data to each of these clusters and measure the distribution changes in these clusters. So when we see that the training data cluster and the production data cluster are shifting in distribution, we can compute the standard drift metrics on top of that. So that allows you to know, okay, so say, let's say you train a model with only cats. Okay. Now suddenly dog images are coming through. Now you can then see that, hey, you would see a massive shift in your cluster distributions because those embeddings will be very different. And so that's how you can cache those issues. And then on top of it, we just overlay these example images so you can look at it. You can see, okay, this cluster has shifted to this cluster. And so this cluster was all about, you know, let's say all cats and cat faces, but then this cluster is showing a lot of dog features. So now you see that shifted a lot.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for explaining how monitoring for unstructured data works at that level. And I started to see more progress and updates from it there related to the adoption and application of these capabilities. That I want to zoom in into a more high level organizational question, since you work with different clients at a very diverse enterprise to adopt, you know, SMPI. I came across this post you wrote on the GitHub blog earlier this year, talking about like setting up model governance while operationalizing machine learning. And you talk about this five-step approach to model governance specifically. So maybe can you walk through like this model governance approach for the modern enterprise?
Yeah. So I think model governance fits in that intersection of MLOps and responsible AI, right? So model governance is a way to think about how do you implement responsible AI within your organization. Really, and obviously in a financial services or any regulated industry like healthcare or recruiting, model governance is mandated by regulations. So they have lots of these OCC regulations, especially in financial service industry, SR 11.7 regulations, where they're mandated to create reports. But essentially, model governance is, in a nutshell, is putting some guardrails around your models and so that multiple stakeholders within an organization can observe how their models are performing. Typically, in these regulated companies, they have these dedicated governance teams or risk management teams or compliance teams for that matter. So their entire job is to minimize the risk for the organization. They report into the chief risk officer. And so they would want to see for every model that gets deployed, the modeling team needs to share them a report. Say, here is what the model was about. Here is what the algorithm that we have chosen. Here are the inputs into the model. Here is the characteristic of these inputs. Here is the output of the model. Here are a few examples of how the model, how it's predicting. And so then they would consume that report and they would say, okay, go ahead and launch the model. Or, no, you need to work on these things. I'm not satisfied with this thing. Why did you select this algorithm or that versus that algorithm? Or I'm not seeing this particular feature. I don't understand this feature, right? So there goes this dialogue between these two teams. And then eventually, once they agree, then the model gets launched. So the model governance is about creating visibility to these non-technical teams, non-modeling teams, like to understand how those models work. And so and implementing regulatory policy, right? So maybe like you say, under the New York City AI hiring law, models should be like this.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where the data scientist team needs to work with the legal team on an HR company. Or under the OCC guidelines, this is what we need to look at. within a model from a risk management perspective. This is where the modeler in a bank would share the report with the model risk manager. So what we are proposing is that essentially you are building all of this model monitoring infrastructure anyway, the operational infrastructure to continuously monitor models. But then being able to create a layer so that we can take these reports and make it friendly for these compliance and legal stakeholders to look at. Right? And so that is the whole point of model governance. And then make it so that make them easier so that they can then be shared with external regulators when they come and visit you and make sure that they follow the guidelines mandated by all these regulations. So it can be standardized. So there's an opportunity for the business to standardize and make it efficient, because otherwise the modeling teams spend months creating these reports and this back and forth goes on and reduces the model velocity. So doing governance can actually really improve velocity, reduce the risks of it. And so the blog that I talk about around, hey, creating an inventory of all the models in one place, creating a way so that you can look at all the validation of the models, why the model was built, what are the features that are important to the model, being able to look at their sort of approvals and denial conversations in one place, being able to have monitoring reports in one place. This is all the five-step process of mapping, validation, approving, monitoring, and improving that can get you to build this quote-unquote responsible AI or regulated AI in your industry, right? So it's a kind of an extension of the core product that we are building. Gets us in to make NPM also work for non-technical teams. Mm-hmm. So yes. That's basically the idea.
Yeah, for sure. I think very important bringing this technology outside and tech domain to regulatory industry, right? And allows this risk and compliant manager to have an opportunity to examine these models in real. And I think you recently were sharing something along the lines of the AI bill surprise, right? Announced by the White House and how FinLows contribute to this, to that movement. And I think model governance, what we discussed about, is like pretty critical part of shaping the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think the AI Bill of Rights talks about all of these things. Right? AI needs to be transparent. AI needs to be reliable. AI should not be discriminating. AI should protect the data privacy. How do you ensure all of that? This is, you need a framework, you need a platform to do that. And that's basically what we are trying to propose with governance.
Yeah, for sure. So let's take off your product hat and put on your CEO hat. Hiring and building culture, a critical responsibility of any startup founder. What valuable lesson have you learned to attract the right people who are excited about FinLows' vision?
Yeah, so I've been obviously building teams for a long time, almost 10 years now. But building a team for a startup, there are some differences. It's in general, when I'm trying to look for candidates, I look for three things: their competence or ability to do the job, their attitude, are they easy to work with? Can my team work with them, or can I work with them? And then passion, right? Are they really passionate about the space? Are they passionate about the problems that they work on? But when it comes to startups, you need to index a lot more on the hunger and the belief in the mission, right? Because that would trump a lot of other things. When you're an early stage startup, you may not be able to track the best ML engineer in the world. You may not be able to attract the best salesperson, the best marketer, the best product person in the world, right? Because you are a nobody. You are a small entity, right? And why would someone take so much risk? And why would someone so highly qualified to come and do whatever? So you'll have to figure out the balance between. And if you can attract them, that's amazing. So what you need to go for is you need to go with your mission. You need to sell them on the vision and the mission. And you need to look for people who are really excited about it and hungry about it. Because if someone is really super hungry about things and they have that drive, then they can acquire that ability over a period of time. They have to have the right attitude, because otherwise they may find the just startup journey to be difficult. So we've made some hiring mistakes as well. And whenever we relaxed on one of those attributes, let's say we were enamored too much by the competency, but ignored the other two attributes. Say, let's say we were bitten. And similarly, when we ignore, say, culture, we had issues like, someone could have amazing ability, but then they were a misfit for the culture, and that was a problematic. So we had some failures as well in the hiring process, but you need to continuously improve, learn from your mistakes that you've done in the past, but broadly speaking, these are the three things that you would see. And from a startup perspective, the additional thing I would see is like the hunger and then the drive to make things happen, right? Because in a startup, you have to make things happen because they won't get happen otherwise. You have to continuously wake up every day and make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you search for hunger during an interview?
Yeah, it's amazing. One of the best salespeople that I hired at Fiddler was someone who didn't even do enterprise sales before. And that person, unfortunately, during the pandemic, they were laid off. And we interviewed that person. They were in their parents' basement. But they were so excited about it. And they basically had this sort of drive to make it happen, to drive to do enterprise sales, to learn this field. And they would. And so you'd have to perceive it, right? You'd have to, when you talk to them, how they talk about their previous companies, what is their outlook towards life, right? And are they prepared to do the risks and do the hard yards that, that sort of come with a startup journey? All of that you need to take into account. Yeah, it's about that. If you have done great work, you have to talk passionately about it. You have to be in the past and you want to learn something and do it with 100%. So I think you need to look for those things in conversations and interview process. So
I want to follow up also on the part about culture a little bit. You've been working on Fiddler for 4.5 years now. Company scale with that aspect as well. I assume the culture was so scale with it. How would you describe that journey, the evolution in the culture from the early days founding team to a bigger size these days?
I mean, we were very small when we could still fit in an office. Now a lot of people are remote, but when we could fit in a very small dinky office in Mountain View, we would do these culture sessions. And one of the things I remember, one of the sessions that we did was asked, what is culture? I asked like this open-ended question and everyone had these answers. One answer was, culture is what we do, right? It's not what we preach. It's not the values that we write on a wiki page. It's not what we advertise on our website. It's the everyday thing that we do. It's like how we behave with each other every day, who gets recognized, who gets respected, who gets rewarded, what behaviors are rewarded, what behaviors are not, right? Those are small things that people notice. That is what makes the culture of the company. And how is it like really full on serious, more you're working really hard, or is like a fun culture, like you're relaxed and you're trying to make things happen, or you're respectful with each other. All of those things is the people, right? So the fundamental element is culture is essentially shaped by the people that you hire. So it's an evolving thing. And it's these small things that you see in the organization. But when you actually hit upon, you have to be conscious about it. As a founder, one of the things that you want to do, you want to start with a set of values that form the foundation of it. And at least becomes the starting point of where you can set the culture. From there on, you have to imbibe new elements into it as you see. Mm-hmm. Because as you build the team, you might bring great people, they might add to the culture. And then you also have to prune off some bad elements of it and keep shaping it. So today I would describe our culture to be like something that is, we're all extremely driven right now. We're extremely passionate. We have gone through an interesting journey in the last 4 years. We've come out of this pretty well. We went through multiple iterations of our product. We've learned what works for our customers. We've learned we've learned a lot of resilience, right? We've basically become a lot of stronger as a team. So that's what I can say right now about the thing that is that we have learned about ourselves in the last 4 years.
Yeah, it's something you culture is also very just like to iterate upon. And to that point about resilience, I think one of the features value on the page that I realize is new anti-fragility. I think that is
okay. Yeah, shows exactly. Yeah, that is the whole resilience, that the whole anti-fragility part. As a startup, we had to go through so much. We started and 1 year later, everything shut down. We went into pandemic and there's so much uncertainty. And then pandemic was in wild and crazy, and then figured out something with the pandemic. And then now, like 2022, we are getting into this whole economy sort of situation. So it's one thing after the other. You just have to ride through these things and become really strong.
Yeah. To that point about anti-fragility and resilience, finding early adopters is notoriously challenging for any enterprise product. And in the case of Fiddler, you guys are building a product and defining a new category simultaneously. So what challenges did your team have to overcome to find the early design partners and define a new category of responsible AI?
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the things that we did differently compared to other enterprise startups is we were never in stealth mode. So we started from day one, we were from out because we had to first evangelize the category while building the product itself. So we could not say that, okay, 3 years later, we'll say, okay, we have come out with this thing. What if the category didn't exist at the time? So we took it upon ourselves to evangelize the category. We were never installed. We kept writing a lot of blogs. We had a data scientist team writing about topics around explainable AI, responsible AI, trustworthy AI. And myself, we've done a lot of, you know, thought leadership, spread the word. So that helped. Number two is like hiring. It's also getting your first product adopters is also like hiring. It's a vision-based sale, right? You have to excite them on the vision and you have to make them the partners amongst your vision. It's as a founder, I suppose I still do that, but that was what I'd done a big part in earlier. I used to go to New York all the time. Because we were focused in financial services industry, meet with a lot of people, talk about their problems and understand their challenges and incorporate some of those ideas, product and give them early releases, beta, pre-beta releases so they can try and give us feedback. We had lots of ML teams try our product early days and give us like lots of valuable feedback in terms of what they want to see, what would work for them. Yeah, evangelize, build thought leadership. You have to hire your product adopters. It's almost like vision. You're selling your vision because they may not give you money early days, but they'll give you time.
Mm-hmm.
That time is so important from a design partner to make your product work for them.
Yeah, thanks for sharing those two ideas. Evangelizing the categories from day one, and as well as a really relentless with meeting where your adopter is, right? Giving them updates, new release, things like that. It's just curious, you work at big tech companies before, is that background give you like an advantage in terms of the network that you can tap on with finding these early design partners?
That's true. Yeah, I think that also was very helpful. Having worked at these tech companies, some of my colleagues went on to lead ML teams or who are either ML engineers or data scientists or worked at companies that they knew other ML teams as I could get introductions and stuff. So definitely helpful. Network is very helpful. Getting good investors was also helpful because these investors could then introduce us to their portfolio companies, building machine learning systems and applications, and also other companies that they know. So we had a lot of a network advantage.
Mm. Yeah. And to that point about the investors network, so Hitler raised, I think, 10 million in Series A and about 60 million in Series B, 32 million Series B. Yeah. So in total, like, 45 minutes to date. And this is from top tier VC firms like Lastfeed, Inside Partners, Lux Capital, and Haystack, just to name a few. What fundraising advice could you give to founders who are seeking the right investors for their startups?
Yeah, it all depends on the stage, right? So when you're starting out your startup, your early stage investors need to really believe in you as an individual or a set of founders and your vision. I think especially believe in you, right? So early stage is all about people. So you need to really hit it off with your early stage investor and it has to go both ways. And as you build the company, build the product out, you will need investors who could like open doors for you, help you hire the rest of the team, help you give good board advice in terms of how to run the company, how to manage all the areas of the company, how to hire stronger leaders for your go-to-market, customer support type teams. So that's the next level of investors, right? Typically, it all depends on the stage of the company. But one thing remains constant is every single round, they're still investing in you as the founder, right? And they're still investing in the people element stays the same, but then the value that they bring to the table will change as you go along and what your expectations from them will also change, right? As you grow the company. Yeah, the best way to kind of raise money is to first socialize yourself and socialize your idea with a broad set of investors and then try to figure out who are the people who are excited. It's again like hiring. It's again, you have to sell your vision. You have to socialize it. You have to get people excited so that they can come behind you, come with you. Because it's a partnership, right? Investors, while they might be investing your money, they're also sharing a lot of time with you. They're also invested their emotions and feelings with the startup. They want the startup to be successful. Once they invest in the startup. And so, yeah, it's a true partnership. You have to like strike a true partnership.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing the context. A lot of similar characteristics between finding employees, finding customers, and finding investors.
Right. Yeah.
So Krishna, at this part of our conversation, I want to move into the final closing segment. And Krishna, I'm going to ask you three rapid fire questions, and then you can provide quick answers for the listeners.
Sure. Yes.
Number one, name three people in the MLOps and responsible AI community whose work you admire.
Yeah, absolutely. I think three people come to mind right away. One is in MLOps, I really admire Goku Mohandas, who runs this Made with ML. I'd say someone, for the listeners who are probably listening to this, don't know this, check out madewithml.com. It's a great MLOps course. And in fact, Goku was on a podcast with Fiddler yesterday itself. So I really like his work in terms of how simple he makes it for people that are new to MLOps to learn. In terms of responsible AI, I think there is an AI ethicist who has been working on responsible AI like us very early days, like even before it became very fashionable. I think Mary Kwok, she's an AI ethicist by background. I respect her work a lot because she was a pioneer like us. She was like working on this stuff. So basically, when I cold called her in 2019, she was curating the list of people and list of companies. She had a website where she would link to like all the companies and tools that exist out there in AI ethics, all just for her own passion, right? It's not because she's doing anything for any, not an organization or anything. So I think there are those people who do this on their own that I have a lot of respect for them. And Merv Hickok is someone I respect in AI ethics and responsible AI. Third, okay, maybe I'll go selfish here. So I would say like Krishna Ram, who's a chief scientist on Fiddler. I think he's very well accomplished, probably not as, I don't know how many people know about it, but he has been working on this thing longer than many people that I've known about and actually built critical systems, whether that's fairness aware machine learning platform at LinkedIn or the ML platform at Amazon. So even before these things were like very popular. So I think his work is something I'm also a big admirer of. Yeah, both with Fiddler and within outside of Fiddler.
I'll be sure to include those profiles in the show notes. Number two, name one book that you would recommend for engineers to cultivate an entrepreneurial mindset.
Yeah, so for me, I can't recommend one book. Like one book, if I were to say, it's probably like a popular book that everyone talks about. It's like The Hard Things About the Hard Things. I think that is a book that left a lot of impact on me. It's also like a personal story of, you know, Ben Horowitz and his startup journey and how he went through the whole ups and downs of it. I think like a lot of other places where I got inspiration for startups, one was from Paul Graham's essays, right? I think his essays are to the point, very concise, very too much to the point, but very hard hitting in terms of what you need to be successful as an entrepreneur. Found them to be very useful. And then general leadership books. I think one of the leadership books that I've found very helpful was The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. I think a lot of company building is also people management, right? So it's being able to build a great team is one of the main responsibilities of being a founder CEO. So The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team is something that I really recommend to anyone in management leadership roles.
Absolutely. Thanks for those two recommendations. And finally, imagine I could send a single tweet to all the early stage machine learning engineers on Twitter. What would you tweet about?
Have you heard about Fiddler? It's probably, yeah, I think I would say, I think this is probably not just for, ML engineers or even early stage ML engineers. I think this is now happening, right? So learn machine learning, I mean, wherever you are. I think this is the field to be right now. This decade is going to be the decade for AI. I would say take up the extra course or take, if you're a software engineer or even remotely interested in machine learning, get on this, right? This is going to be where the software 2.0 is going to be built. This is going to be an entire refactoring of the software that we have known to be ML-based software. So it's a huge shift that we are going to see in this decade. So get on this journey, get on the bandwagon and try to learn, contribute, whatever you can. If you are excited about MLOps tools and responsible AI, we are hiring. Come apply at Fiddler. Email me at krishna@fiddler.ai. Yeah, so that's my advice.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to conclude our conversation. So Krishna, I really enjoyed chatting with you today, learning about your educational background in computer science at Minnesota, your early career working on Microsoft Bing, your engineering management leadership, Twitter, Pinterest and Facebook, various lessons learned about building data infrastructure during those periods, the founding journey, Fiddler to build a responsible AI, the model performance management framework that Fiddler is pioneering, various technical threats related to building product, adding customers, employees, and investors, as well as in general, great discussion on the evolution of MLOps, the machine stack software to bio, as well as model governance and how the enterprise and more regulatory industry can incorporate ML into the day-to-day workflow. I'll be sure to include everything that we discussed today in the show notes so listeners can have a chance to take a look, learn more about Fiddler, follow up if they're interested in some of the work you're doing, and keep up to date with the upcoming release of the product and the events the company is putting on. I really enjoy chatting with you today, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Oh, thank you so much, James. This is a great interview. And yeah, have a nice day. And have a nice day, everyone. Thank you so much.
Well, that's the wrap for another episode of DataCast. Hopefully, you have learned something insightful and interesting from my guest today. You can read the show notes from the podcast website at datacast.simplecast.fm. If you want to get instant updates when a new episode is released, either follow me on Twitter or subscribe to my newsletter on my website, jamescaley.com. It is my greatest pleasure that you listen to this podcast and take advantage of the data revolution coming upon us. Goodbye for now.